Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 823.PS5707, certificate number 25729, Nadia's theme.
Well, this is going to be a show full of personal anecdote, I predict.
No one has ever heard you talking about the mid-70s on this show.
I think you're going to have some anecdotes here, too.
When you told me you were doing Nadia's theme, I was so excited.
Yeah, you were.
I immediately had three different angles of storytelling.
I don't even know if I should include any facts or really anything. We should just start telling stories about...
Let's just play Nadia's theme once, and then there will be a... You'll have 20 minutes to talk about it, and I'll have 20-minute rebuttal.
I feel like our beloved editor and third Beatle, Mark Miles, could just be playing Nadia's theme throughout this entire episode.
Wouldn't it make us seem more graceful?
Yeah, like 50 minutes of it, just... it would. Well, graceful, but also sad and moving and...
tempestuous.
Yeah. You grew up watching American television on Armed Forces Radio.
Yeah, it's weird that Armed Forces Radio had pictures. We could just imagine what Casey Kasem looked like. But, no, they had a TV service.
But it was kind of an eclectic mix, right? How much, was it all contemporary, or did you see old movies too? Did you watch The Munsters?
They, in addition to the new shows, which was stuff that was maybe 6 months or so out of date in the U.S., which they would cycle through full seasons of, they would also just, you know, they'd fill odd times, like a U.S. affiliate with just whatever they had in the back.
Uh-huh.
So I've seen the first season of The Odd Couple 20 times and none of the subsequent ones because awesome. They only had one.
That first season's really good, though.
They had, it's actually before they start hanging out with celebrities. It's a little more like the Neil Simon play.
Yeah.
Bunch of Star Trek. But yeah, weird old, you know, like a lot of Army movies, you know, like they knew who their audience was. So a lot of John Wayne. Green berets, flying leathernecks, that kind of a thing.
Did it have soap operas?
Yes. Every day when I came home from school. I mean, the mythology, because I've told the story so many times, is that I would come home from school excited to watch Jeopardy. And that's 100% true. But in fact, I think Jeopardy didn't start till like 5, which meant I got home sometime during the 2-hour power programming block for our servicemen and women of Guiding Light and General Hospital.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, my babysitter had the three channels of American television, and one of them was doing game shows, Price is Right, all the way until the afternoon.
Yeah, NBC had a full morning of game shows throughout the 80s, and CBS had Price is Right on, you know, until today.
Yeah, and Wheel of Fortune, I think.
Was a daytime Wheel of Fortune on, I want to say ABC, but maybe I'm wrong. CBS?
And then the soaps. So it was kind of depending on her mood. She definitely followed the soap operas.
Oh, but she didn't have one of her programs that she always watched?
I think she did, but it was before we got home from school. But then in the afternoon, you know, she could kind of be persuaded to flip over maybe even to see Hogan's Heroes if you were on, really on your good behavior. But otherwise, yeah, you were watching Guiding Light.
Even back then, you were trying to make the show be about Hitler.
Yeah, I really...
You were like, there's very little Hitler on All My Children today.
Schultz!
We should explain soap operas to a far future audience, but also to a 2022 audience.
Well, I wonder...
That is not aware of their one-time societal... import.
You have talked about doing an episode just on soap operas.
I'm going to do a show about the mainstreaming of General Hospital in the 1980s. We're doing a Luke and Laura show, and it's coming up.
But can you, in a nutshell, describe to somebody that hasn't experienced it the phenomenon of soap operas?
Yeah, what's the one sentence? I mean, the main thing
they were every day.
They were aimed at women.
Initially.
Yeah, because of that's who's home during the day.
They were extremely dramatic.
The labor-saving devices of the 20th century meant that homemakers suddenly had a few hours free.
Every episode, which was every day, didn't just have one cliffhanging dramatic moment where everybody gasped, but it had multiple ones per episode.
Every scene would end with some kind of...
Somebody like, oh, no.
Some kind of moment of turbulent
Turns out he's actually his evil brother. Amazing that they could keep that many plots going.
Many of the plot lines were romance themed, but not always. So they could delve into crime and high adventure. Yeah. They were made incredibly cheaply on stages in New York City by a group of actors that loved the steady work. And had been unable to break in.
But like a lot of famous people came from the soaps, Rick Springfield and didn't George Clooney?
Rick Springfield
was on a soap opera.
I would use Alec Baldwin as my example before Rick Springfield, although maybe, you know, Rick Springfield hasn't shot anybody lately.
At the time, Rick Springfield was a very, very big star, Ken, I'll have you know.
Yeah, I mean, General Hospital was turning out pop stars then.
Yeah.
Jack Wagner, John Stamos. Again, this is cannibalizing from my Luke and Laura show.
Yeah, but that's everybody that's listening, just forget all of this stuff so Ken can talk about it again in another episode. But yeah, the soaps, I mean, I tried everything I could to avoid them, but...
Oh, you didn't get sucked in. Because I found that if you would, you know, I'd find them impenetrable, and then I'd watch them for 3 days, and it really works. You're like, wait, is she alive? That car looked like it was going pretty fast, but we have to know what happened with the surgery, or are they really the same person? They haven't revealed whose hand that was.
You know how it was when you read the funnies every day, and one day you were like, you know what, I'm going to read Mary Worth, and then after a week of it, you're like, oh, I'm engaged in the plot line of Mary Worth. And then you read it for a month and you go, oh, the plot line of Mary Worth goes nowhere. Like nothing is ever resolved. Nothing ever happens. And, you know, I think that probably that happened to me with soap operas at a young age. But also the production values, just the fact that those stages were also shadowy.
Shot on videotape with the cheapest lighting.
Like, and you could tell that they were bad actors. It just felt like...
Well, they had all gotten their pages that morning. I mean, think of how that must be to turn out an hour show every day.
Every day. Only Luke Burbank can say what it's really like.
I mean, Jeopardy, I only do half an hour, and it's a long day.
Yeah. Well, and you're reading a teleprompter. Were they?
I'm not reading a teleprompter.
There's not a teleprompter somewhere?
I think they must have been off on prompter, you know, or had sides just out of...
Yeah, but you don't see them doing screen. It. You know, you wouldn't see them like you do on Saturday Night Live.
I mean,
Live.
You're putting these actors down, but they are very good at that particular
That's
craft.
True. That's
they,
true.
They're doing something difficult and fast every day.
And a lot of them are on TV for 40 years.
And a lot of them become huge celebrities. Like, no one's ever heard of them, but to your grandma, they're the biggest star. Like, you go to the... They still publish Soap Opera Digest, I think, even though there's maybe three daytime soaps left. And you'll still see some of the same faces on the cover of Soap Opera Digest.
Rolling Stone.
And like they're the biggest celebrities in that world, because they are. I found that there was a big social aspect to it. Like, because me and all my friends were locked into Armed Forces TV, we would all come home and watch...
Oh.
Guiding Light in General Hospital.
And then call each other up and breathlessly recap?
About, I mean, we were talking about it at school the next day. Oh, wow. There was a period where General Hospital was doing a lot of kind of faux, low-budget spy stuff.
Uh-huh.
The good spies of the World Security Bureau, the WSB, were always facing off against the DVX, the crypto-Soviet agency that was always infiltrating Port Charles, New York, for some reason.
Sure, with of course.
With its Iron Curtain spies.
Of course, they were trying to bust those Grateful Dead concerts, those early 80s Dead shows.
And when there was a twist, we would like call and be like, oh my gosh, the assistant police chief is the crime boss? Or, you know, like we were, something about it, I mean, maybe this is Listomania, something about knowing your friends were following this dumb thing, you'd get into it too.
How interesting. And it may just be the 5-year difference in our ages, but
it's true.
When I was a kid, it was exclusively the province of housewives and babysitters. And the idea that I or any of my friends would have watched a soap voluntarily.
If you're homesick, you watch game shows.
Yeah, absolutely. Or Hogan's Heroes.
Yeah, Brady Bunch or something. Yeah. That's the American way. But the accident of Armed Forces programming, plus, again, preview, the brief period in the 80s when General Hospital kind of tipped above the waterline of the iceberg and briefly became a national moment. We were into it.
Well, let's save that for another show. I'm looking very forward to hearing about General Hospital in the 80s.
Who wouldn't want to hear us talk about for an hour about that?
Well, let's set the Wayback Machine to a little bit earlier. In 1971, let's say. Now, this is...
For example.
This is before you were born.
A young John Roderick is 1 or 2 years old.
Yeah, well, three. I was three.
Eating strained peas from a plastic spoon.
You know, by that point in time, I was probably...
You could have been riding a bike with training wheels.
Yeah.
You're riding a big wheel.
I was. I had a big wheel. We were living in Alaska at the time, so, you know, I had a really big wheel.
Sliding all over the ice on your big wheel.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to... set the Wayback Machine to 1970.
A young John Roderick is... A mere year and a half old.
Yeah, a year and a half, two, let's say. I would have turned, I would have turned two in the fall of 1970. Would have been, you know, riding my trike. It was pre-big wheel, so I would have had a trike. I have a picture of the trike, actually.
I had a little red trike that it's totemic for me to imagine it.
Yeah, I think mine was orange because, you know, my parents were iconoclasts.
But I wouldn't want to stand out in the snow there.
An author by the name of Glendon Swarthout.
Oh, that's fake.
Who was at the time, you know, in his late 40s, maybe 50. He would have 52. Wrote a book called Bless the Beasts and the Children. And it was a kind of a little bit of an environmentalist novel. It was a little bit of sort of the, you know, I was thinking the other day, one of the things that characterizes Generation X and all of the media that we produced as, in our brief period, as makers of sad dad rock and whatever
else.
We
didn't get long. No, why did the boomers get 60 years?
Well, there are twice as many of them as us.
They outnumber us.
But one of the things that characterizes us is that we talked a lot about our personal lives and our childhoods. You know, there weren't a ton of boomer rock bands that talked about their parents. Maybe
that's because their fathers never spoke more than six words in a row to them.
Yeah. But mostly they, you know, a lot of their music was in the present tense. They were getting high or having the sex or whatever it was.
They were doing the mashed potato. They were doing the twist.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the Cats in the Cradle is an example of a kind of,
but that's why that's the example. Cause it's like no one had heard anybody, one of these guys, sing about their dad before.
Yeah, so sentimental. And maybe The City of New Orleans is about the death of the railroads, but for the most part, and even that was present tense.
Yeah.
But then all of our music and culture, Generation X, it was all, except for Friends, was all very, you know, introspective and psychological. And Bless the Beasts and the Children was this kind of novel that was... it was about troubled kids, and it was about the plight of the American buffalo. It was, you know, kind of a combination of all these 60s.
I never read or saw it. It's set in the 60s. It's not a period. I always assumed it was some kind of a frontier thing.
No. It was a contemporary book, and it got made into a movie shortly thereafter.
Right.
No less a person than Stanley Kramer, the director.
Maybe my least favorite American director.
Is that right?
Yeah, the preachiest. I like Judgment at Nuremberg a lot, actually. Yeah. But
you don't like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner?
Defiant Ones.
The Kane Mutiny?
Actually, I kind of like the Kane Mutiny. But
High Noon?
Inherit the Wind, he does these kind of stagey playhouse 90 things that you're like, what? Why is it, they just haven't aged that well.
I guess I watched High Noon not that long ago and I was like, God, why don't you just leave town? Like, go.
Yeah, I really want to like High Noon, and I'd rather watch Shane or Rio Bravo any day of the week.
Well, Kramer read this novel and he got into a bidding war. He really wanted to make the movie.
Kramer from Seinfeld did this?
Yeah, Kramer from
Jerry,
Seinfeld.
Jerry, I'm in a bidding war. It's a bidding war, Jerry.
Wow. No, Stanley Kramer got into this kerfuffle trying to make this film.
Must have been a hit novel.
It was a popular novel. And it was, you know, it was a message book.
It's funny. This guy's he's got an ecological take, even though most of his books are Westerns, right?
Yeah.
The John Wayne movie, The Shootist, is based on a book of his, it looks like, which I didn't know.
And this has this, you aren't wrong that it has a frontier kind of tone to it. The plot was that a group of misfit teens were sent to a boys camp called the Arizona Box Canyon Boys Camp.
Oh, like a Scared Straight kind of a.
Yeah. And they're all misfits in their own individual way.
There's a princess, an athlete, a brain, a basket case, and a.
Well, they're more 70s misfits, where they're, you know, like
it's a dropout, a dropout, a dropout, a dropout, yeah, and a dropout.
Truly troubled kids that get bullied. The other kids at the camp nicknamed their little squad the Bedwetters. Mm. They're all kind of abused by their absentee parents or, you know, they are truly the troubled kids, not the comically troubled kids that you see in the Breakfast Club.
Right.
This is back when you could make a movie where kids really get brutalized. That fell out of fashion later on, maybe for obvious reasons, and maybe something was lost. but these kids really have a rough go of it. And the lead teen, or the teen that kind of steps forward and says, like, hey, you know, we shouldn't take this abuse, because they're taking abuse from the other kids in the camps.
Even among the misfits, they're the misfits.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a boys' camp that, for some people, kind of like my experience at Outward Bound, some of the kids there are having a camp experience, and some of them are having an awful experience.
I see. Not everybody is there by court order.
And there's a sociopathic camp counselor who's a real bully.
Nurse Ratchet type.
Yeah, everybody's getting pushed around. And the Bedwetters end up fighting the good fight in a way that brings them together. Like, they unite in their brokenness, in their awkwardness. And there's a herd of buffalo.
Twist.
That figures in the film.
That is not the second act twist in many novels. Suddenly, a herd of buffalo. I mean,
and then
it would really improve Catch 22.
A herd of buffalo. No one expects a herd of buffalo, but it's kind of like the Electric Horseman. There were a lot of movies in the 70s that featured wild horses or some kind of mechanism where they personify or they exemplify the loss of the American West.
Sure. It's the dying cowboy in Last Picture Show.
Yeah. It's the sad Indian on the side of the road when you throw your garbage out the window.
Right.
It's just a way that filmmakers and culture makers had of communicating. Well, it's like the city of New Orleans, right? The train conductor says, "Driver, right, take a break."
Well, the oldest people of that generation were dying, you know, like that was the time when the last living cowhands and, you know, the Native Americans who remembered that period were dying.
Sure. In 1970, a 70-year-old could conceivably remember a frontier that still had a little, I mean, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid was, so yeah, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, that was all early 20th century. So this was in living memory.
Sundance Kid lived in 1937, if the stories are true about him surviving the,
right,
the shootout.
That's like, they saw him, somebody saw him in a post office
somewhere. A guy who looked a lot like him was buying something at Woolworth's.
But Butch died in...
Yeah, the shootout was 1908.
1908, yeah. Right. Anyway, and then, so the kids identify with the buffalo. The buffalo are penned in. The sociopathic counselor is hunting them, wow, or shooting them, you know, supposedly culling the herd, but really he's just a killer. And these buffalo are, you know, they need to be free. They need to be free to ride their machines.
This is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
This is Buffalo instead of Chief.
And so the kids, take on the cause of the buffalo. I won't give away the ending, but there's a kind of tragic ending.
Have you seen the movie?
I have.
Is it good?
Well, so what happened to me, in the 1970s, my mom, in the mid-70s, she had a boyfriend named Norm. And Norm was pretty norm. He actually smoked a pipe. Classic 70s dad, smoked a pipe.
Named Norm.
And Norm had four kids. And the kids were kind of, my sister and I were in age, kind of fit right into his group of kids. And he had a son that was the same age as me, but he and I didn't get along. His name was also John. But the son that was older than me, Andy, was considerably older than me, 3 or 4 years at a time when I was... what, 7 or 8 years old, I guess, and he would have been 12. Andy took me under his wing, and he was my, he kind of taught me to, I think as a younger kid, I was a little bit in a shell, a little timid. And Andy was the one that, you know, we would roam the whole city. Like, we would go get on a city bus. They lived in the U District. And he would just take me downtown. Oh, yeah, and he was a little bit of a... You know, his mother had died. He was a little bit of a troubled kid, and we would get into scrapes. Like, we would go into a downtown office building, and Andy would light 2 smoke bombs and throw them in an elevator right as the doors were closing. Like, a lot of stuff that maybe I should have, maybe as I lost my timidity, I shouldn't have learned quite that much about causing trouble in the world.
You should have falsified some of the details so you didn't know how to make your own smoke bombs.
Yeah, we got into a lot of trouble. He was the one that taught me how to pinch a whistling Pete with a pair of pliers and make it explode. Anyway, one night, Andy and I were watching TV, and we were in... They had a Airstream parked out in back of their house, and he and I were kind of living in it. And there was a little black and white TV in there, and we were watching The Late Show. And they played Bless the Beasts and the Children, which at that time, the movie came out in 71. We would have been watching it in 75, maybe. And the movie just devastated me because it was about kids that were Andy's age. And it has a, you know, it's any kid kind of maybe feels like a misfit. I certainly did. And in 1975 or 6, I definitely was still wetting the bed. So them being called bedwetters really resonated with me. But in particular, I remember the soundtrack to the film because it was extremely affecting.
The title song is very catchy and memorable.
So the title song was recorded by the Carpenters.
Yep.
And was a B-side that of a record that went to number 2, but there's a music video for it.
Four Non-Blondes covered it on that 90s era Carpenters tribute album, I remember. And this is my brush with fame. Sang it in my 5th grade music class.
You didn't.
Yeah, we had some music textbook that had a bunch of that kind of soppy Anne Murray sounding 70s stuff in it.
Super soppy.
Some actually radio hits like Bless the Beats and the Children, and some just kind of made up pastiche things that to this day I cannot Google. Like, me and all my friends in that class can still sing every word to Sunny Lane, and we thought these were real pop songs because we were singing them in 5th grade choir. And then you Google these things and they don't exist because it was just one Houghton Mifflin music textbook from 1978. But we sang Bless the Beast and the Children.
It's classic, easy listening, proto yacht rock, right?
If you listen Gold. To
it, the Carpenters version, there's just a lot of strings. It's really, really treacly.
I mean, and Karen, the best vocalist of the decade, perhaps.
And really, you know, the progenitor of well, that's another word I should stop using, right? In addition to, what were the other two? I got to stop saying progenitor.
Well, you should probably say progenitor.
Or whatever.
Maybe if you start saying it right, people will consider it a different word. drummer too, by the way. Were we talking about this on the show?
Karen Carpenter?
I just went down a rabbit hole of watching Karen Carpenter drumming videos for 2 hours.
She was phenomenal. She was phenomenal.
Good Lord.
And they didn't want her to sit behind the drum kit. They wanted her to be out front because she was a beautiful lady. But her drumming is what made that music, I think. More than his Rhodes playing.
And he's not even much of a singer. You listen to their Christmas record, which I did a couple months ago.
Sure, of course you did.
For hours at a time, because it's Mindy's favorite Christmas record. And Whoa. he can't even sing. I guess he's a great arranger or something.
Well, great arranger is not nothing. But yeah, I'm still reeling from the fact that Mindy's favorite Christmas record is the Carpenters one. Has she never heard Man, I Am Steamroller?
It's the only Christmas record she's ever heard. It's both her favorite and her least favorite. I mean, I just play the Phil Spector over and over and she gets tired of it.
Well, the movie, Bless the Beasts and the Children, was scored by a pair of songwriters. The songwriter, Barry Dvorzon, and the arranger, Perry Botkin, did a whole score for the film. Barry Dvorzon was the guy that first signed the association to his record label, Valiant Records. So he was like a music guy. He went on to write the music for the film The Warriors. Like he was a songwriter, had some collaborations with some folks, and then Perry Botkin was an arranger that that also had a pretty long CV, one that you wouldn't maybe know everything on it. But interestingly, he was the arranger for the Incredible Bongo Band. The Incredible Bongo Band being a band from the era.
The Bonzo Dog Band?
No, the Bongo Band. They did covers of tunes where they featured the bongos.
See?
There was a lot of bongo playing.
Are there really a lot of songs where you can just sub in most of the instruments with bongos? I'm a little skeptical. Like if you'd said they were an accordion or a banjo cover band, I can hear that in my head.
Well,
I feel like you can't really replace most lead instruments with the bongo.
Yeah, I mean, there are other instruments, but you do a lot of long drum breaks.
I see.
And that's where Perry Botkin made a lot of money in his life, because some of those drum breaks were later sampled by rap artists.
Oh,
the bongo band
classic breaks
created one of the most famous breaks, the Apache break, that gets used in everything. And so Botkin's always like collecting these royalty checks.
Well, let's see. Dvorzon's still alive. Botkin died in 73. Botkin had no idea that he was going to receive his greatest fame in, this is his son.
Perry Botkin.
His dad was an arranger.
Yeah.
Perry Botkin Jr. died in, he died a year ago. So he did live to see his...
Oh, yeah. He lived to see it.
Every kid in Brooklyn and Queens love him.
He was often very confused about what was happening. Although he continued to be an arranger, he wasn't sure about, all this rap music and whatnot. But
I am also unsure what's happening. So
The two of them recorded this soundtrack to Bless the Beasts and the Children. And one of the kind of incidental music pieces was some theme music that they wrote for the character John Cotton, the main kid.
He's the kid.
And it was called Cotton's Theme. And it was just a kind of, interstitial music played under Cotton. And I remember this music from watching it as a kid, because it reoccurs.
The score is memorable enough that you remembered incidental music.
I remembered watching it on this little black and white TV and being really moved by the music, and in particular the way the music scores the events of the film. This song comes in a way that really connected with me. So there was a soundtrack, because the Carpenters sang the title track. There was a soundtrack for the film that included all of this stuff. The soundtrack sold all right, but then crucially, and I have to admire him for this, Perry Botkin Jr. Rearranged Cotton's Theme, which had, which had made no stir in the world as a incidental music. Sure. On the back of this soundtrack record.
As most of them don't.
He rearranged it for the premiere of The Young and the Restless, a brand new soap opera that appeared in 1973.
Is that unusual to reuse incidental music from a movie as a TV theme?
Well, as someone who is always trying to take his very limited set of ideas and repurpose them over and over, I really admire somebody that's like, you know, I put this out and it didn't really connect the way I wanted. What if I just changed it around and turned it into this? It's not that common to release a thing and then call it something else, but he was the arranger of the original track. It wasn't anything. It was just a backing track. Yeah. Why not convert it to the sound or the theme for The Young and the Restless? And it really connected with people as the theme to The Young and the Restless. And for obvious reasons, when you see the opening credits of The Young and the Restless, this music in this new context, and it's a rearrangement of the album track, but still, you know, it's very there. And it, again, it's very moving music. And now set apart, it connects with an audience.
And you listen to it 5 times a week if you're a fan of the show. Like, those soap themes just become iconic.
Yeah.
Like, I can still tell you the font used in every daytime soap I watched as a kid just because you're seeing it every day.
And this music is dramatic, and it's sad. And so then The Young and the Restless actually released a soundtrack record.
Seems a little unusual.
But, you know, this was the 70s. And, I mean, the 70s, as we'll see at the end of the show, this is an era when the theme music to television shows, actually, the 60s and 70s, a lot of it appeared on the pop charts. Peter Gunn theme, Hawaii 5-0 theme.
Theme from SWAT.
I mean, these were all hit songs, or in a lot of cases, hit songs. So Young and the Restless put out a record.
Makes you wonder where they're on the radio, where people are calling into their rock radio stations and requesting.
Oh, for sure. Because they were some funky jams. A lot of them funky jams.
I think they should still play the Barney Miller theme on the radio today.
Boom.
That would be a break.
Boom. Speaking of Wawa, in 1974, the soundtrack to The Young and the Restless came out, and the theme had been re-recorded by an easy listening group called Sounds of Sunshine.
Is this their big hit? I've never heard of Sounds of Sunshine.
And they actually have lyrics on Cotton's theme, on the Young and the Restless theme.
Did they add their own lyrics?
There were not lyrics on any prior version.
Hmm.
And their version of the song, the vocals actually do some of the melody that the original version would have been, you know, orchestral. They actually kind of handle the main theme in their vocals. There's a lot of wah-wah on that track.
Hmm.
And that was, you know, kind of not, it didn't rip up the charts in 1974. But so now there were three versions of the song out there. There was the original soundtrack version. There was the Young and the Restless theme, which was a rearrangement. And now this pop, Sounds of Sunshine.
Pop version,
which was on the soundtrack. Well, 2 years later, a little event you might remember.
I will not remember. I was 2 years old.
Yeah. Well, 1976.
The tall ships are in the harbor.
An event that I remember very, very clearly. It was the 1976 Olympics.
Were those in 1976?
The 1976 Olympics occurred, coincidentally, in 1976.
I thought there was some French-Canadian thing where it was actually 1977 there already.
Well, yeah, that's right. Canada is across the international date line from the United States, the north-south or the east-west international date line. And famously at the 1976 Olympics, Nadia Comaneci, someone we've talked about on the show before.
Probably come up here more than any other Romanian gymnast.
Right. I would say absolutely true. And
by a wide margin.
And she was, along with Betty Rubble, a proto...
was she a Jane Wiedlin for you?
She was an archetype of a Jane Wiedlin.
See, I was fixated on Olga Korbut. See, it's totally... No,
we're different.
I'm just kidding.
I was in love with Nadia. She wasn't that much older than me. What was I? I was 8 years old, and she was 12.
Right. This could happen.
This could still happen. It still could. Well, she's still married
to Bart Connor?
She's happily married to Bart Connor. Yeah, living in Arizona. She was born in Babylona. Moved to Arizona.
Well, she's probably closer than most celebrities. I mean, she's born 400 miles from Babylonia, right?
Right. Right. Although that's the opposite. It's opposite day. But so she won the first 10 in the Olympics and then won some subsequent 10s.
The first perfect 10. The perfect 10. Ever scored in, I can't remember what it was. The balance beam.
Yeah.
That's what I'm picturing. The funny thing is my childhood includes a very strong memory of watching the TV movie version of this.
Oh.
But not featuring Nadia, featuring
a separate person?
I don't know who played her.
No. We'll get to that because it was.
Oh, you know about this?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, so I can picture the 1.0 coming up and the crowd being confused at the low score, but I'm not picturing ABC footage. I'm picturing this TV movie.
Well, I was watching the Olympics and it was extraordinary. It was, you know, you were too confused to be moved like we are now because now it's presented kind of universally. It's always scored with music. And that was a thing that began very shortly after the Olympics. ABC Wide World of Sports created a montage of all of her performances.
She did not do the floor exercise to Nadia's theme?
No.
I guess that would have been pretty egotistical of her.
She did her floor exercises to two songs. One, the first one, Yes Sir, That's My Baby, which was
the biggest hit of 1976. I loved when the association did that as the B-side to Cherish.
It's actually been covered a lot by all the sort of 60s era crooners, but it was a 1920s sort of sheet music song. Yeah. And then the other song was Jump in the Line. By Harry Belafonte.
Because she loved the bongos.
Yeah. Or Sir Kitchener, I guess, wrote it.
Wow.
But no, Nadia's theme did not appear. But someone at ABC, familiar with this song from its prior incarnation.
Because Young and the Restless is an ABC soap, right?
So yeah, and it's on TV at this point. It's now 3 years old. They score this montage of all of Nadia's greatest Olympic hits to the Young and the Restless.
That's a little weird.
To this music.
Because today it's not uncommon for sports shows and package shows to use, you know, music, to play music under this stuff. But you would never use a daytime theme song for this, right?
Right.
You'd want something with a little higher pedigree.
Well, and what's amazing is, again, this music is underscoring, literally, her performances. It just imparted this incredible drama that they were hoping for.
It's the exact right music for them.
Yeah, where you're just like, where what it does is it brings out all the emotion in her getting those perfect tens that when it first aired on TV, you're just like, what's happening? Oh my God, a 10? You know, there's astonishment, there's confusion. You can see it in her face and in her coach's face. Like there's no jumping up and down. They're like, what's going on? But with this music, this kind of piano ballad that takes a long time to evolve, it's just the perfect thing. And the kind of fandom, the global fascination with her in that moment meant that this montage was watched by millions of people and became in itself the kind of definitive document of her accomplishment.
All over the world, more people saw that music video version of it than the original events.
And all of a sudden, everybody wanted this music.
Which had originated in a Stanley Kramer movie 5 years ago.
Barry Dvorzon immediately retitled it Nadia's Theme. It had always been Cotton's theme until then.
Take that, Cotton.
And A&M Records released it, released the 1971 film soundtrack version in 1976 as a pop single. It rocketed up the charts and spent 22 weeks in the Hot 100 and got to a peak of number 8.
Am I wrong that this kind of still happens? Like a piece will be used by a figure skater and suddenly it'll be rediscovered and nowadays can even chart?
Well, yeah, that's why Jump in the Line ended up in Beetlejuice. Unfortunately, A&M actually left Dvorzon's name off of the record when they released it, and he sued them successfully for $240,000 for I think the insult and maybe even the lost revenue. Although I'm not sure, they certainly could have corrected that in the revenue department. Anyway, he successfully sued,
but not in the insult. They'd have to add his name onto a song he did not write.
Oh, right.
And have that go.
Yeah, maybe they go platinum. They could have done.
They should have that. They should have makeup.
Sweet
stuff
Emotion
like
or something.
Some Meatloaf song.
Yeah, right about the same time. But then there was quickly a kind of this song, and I remember it very much being the song of 1976. There were a lot of songs in 1976. It was a great year for music.
But for you, nothing spoke to you like Nadia's.
Well, I forget what was when did Devil Woman by Cliff Richard come out? That was also I was really into that song at the time. And I think Convoy by C.W. McCall, which we've talked about on
the
show.
We've already put Convoy in the
Yeah, list. I think that's all about the same time. But right after, in October, a record company called Pip Records released the Sounds of Sunshine version of the song.
They re-released the original pop version.
Yeah, and then re-released the Young and the Restless soundtrack, both of which sold. Those were, trying to capitalize on it.
Well, this must be weird for the Young and the Restless, which is now continuing to use as its theme song a pop song more popular as something else.
Right. This is now Nadia's theme, and every week tune into the show and you're like, it's Nadia's theme, but I mean, I guess it reciprocates.
Yeah, I'm sure they're happy to have the hit, but just unprecedented for a TV show.
Well, also in October 76, Dvorzon himself releases his first solo album, and the solo album is called Nadia's Theme.
Hmm.
And then right after that, Sounds of Sunshine release an album also called Nadia's Theme.
What does Nadia think about it? Like, her name, she has no rights of publicity here. Her name is basically being taken in vain, and her celebrity is being used to sell instrumental records.
Well, she went back to Romania, where she was given 3 squares a day and not allowed out of the sight of her handlers, her KGB handlers, because they were terrified that she was going to defect. So yeah, all of this was happening. Sort of in the same style of Charles Dickens coming to the United States and being feted everywhere, but not having copyright over his books.
I just wonder if it would have been different if she'd actually been Western European.
For sure.
And could have been like, hey, you can't just...
Well, she would have gotten a cut.
Yeah, exactly.
And then what you remember is the November of 76 CBS dramatization, Nadia from Romania with Love. Nadia from Romania with Love, which was narrated by Flip Wilson.
No. That does exist, but I'm remembering a biopic.
Oh, with another actress.
Yes.
So playing the role of Nadia. Was it Mary Lou Retton?
No, it's one Johann Carlo, whose credits I do not recognize. Oh, she's the cabbie on Pee-wee's Playhouse, on the first season of Pee-wee's Playhouse. That's funny. Her dad in this movie is actually played by Jonathan Banks, Mike from Breaking Bad.
Oh.
Which I would not have been able to tell you. But and Talia Balsam plays Bela Karoli's wife. No, this is a TV movie that I'm sure I'm the only person alive who has ever seen. But I want to see the Flip Wilson one now. I'm a Nadia completist.
I know.
Do you think ABC let CBS use the...
They must have. Well, no, thing? I mean, maybe they got it from Barry Dvorzon.
Maybe they withheld it and CBS had to use the, the Bold and the Beautiful theme or something.
What's interesting is that this was not the first instrumental song by Barry Dvorzon to top the charts in 1976.
What?
Cotton's Theme, Nadia's Theme, peaked at number 8, but Barry Dvorzon had a number one hit in February of 76 with the theme from SWAT.
I think the theme from SWAT was like the last TV hit to be a number one until, I don't know, like The Greatest American Hero didn't do it, like something pretty recently.
Well, there was another number one song in 1976 from a TV show, which was the Welcome Back Cotter theme by John Sebastian, also went to number one.
I just think of that as incidentally a TV theme.
It's a pretty great tune.
And I think he might have sung it on, did he sing it on the first SNL? I feel like he's the musical guest on the first SNL.
I thought it was Paul Simon. Mm. Welcome back. I still know every word of it. But yeah, believe it or not, I'm Walking on Air was a hit in 81. Making Our Dreams Come True from Laverne and Shirley only got to number 25.
You've got a list.
I do. Suicide is Painless was a hit in the UK, a number one hit in the UK. And then, of course, the Miami Vice theme.
Oh, that's what it was. It was Miami Vice.
In 1985 by Jan Hammer.
Greatest American Hero didn't quite get there. And then after that, here's the one I think I'm thinking of, although, you know, this is not more recent at all. In the 90s, How Do You Talk to an Angel from The Heights?
Right, The Heights, and that song was actually credited to a band called The Heights.
Are they like the Archies?
They're like the Archies. And then hilariously, the day after How Do You Talk to an Angel got to number one on the charts, they canceled the television show The Heights. So too bad for
them. I mean, it's not too different than The Greatest American Hero, where everyone remembers the song more than any single thing that ever happened on the show.
I loved that show.
It was the only show that had like superhero stuff on TV.
Yeah, and it was hilarious because he couldn't control his suit.
Whoa! He's flailing around.
Crash.
The aliens gave him the instructions, but he lost
them.
He lost the instructions.
Yeah.
Classic IKEA superhero comic.
You know, he's probably Mormon.
Because he lost the instructions.
Yeah.
I have no idea what that means.
He lost the gold tablets.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, yes. He lost them. Couldn't control the suit.
They're always in the last place you look.
Well, Nadia's theme ended up winning the Grammy Award in 1977, Best Instrumental Grammy. So one would think that was the end of the story.
It's already had more lives than a cat.
But in fact, it became the foundation many years later of Mary J. Blige's hit, No More Drama.
No.
Yeah.
Is it sampled or?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah. So no More Drama is happening, and that's a Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis jam,
as it were.
And they loved Nadia's theme. They'd been trying to put it into a tune forever. They came up with this backing track, and Mary J. Blige said, "Are you guys following me around? Because this is like exactly what I wanted to do next, exactly what I heard in my mind."
I remember this because she actually says, "Or maybe I like the stress because I was young and restless." But that was long ago. She actually name checks the
right. The CBS, she was hearing soap. It as the soap theme.
I think I said it was ABC, but it's CBS, huh? So that means Wide World of Sports or whatever was going cross network to borrow the Young and the Restless theme.
Oh, interesting. We talked about that a lot, and yet it turned out we were wrong.
Assuming ABC had the Olympics that year.
We're like scientists, Ken. We are not afraid to admit we were wrong.
When the research shows that our hypothesis about Young and the Restless being on ABC is wrong, we will go back and we will redo the work.
We'll admit it. And some, you know, you were kind of broadly implying that ABC was cross promoting,
but no,
it turns out this was like some kind of shared, it was like a universe of shared content.
It would be like CBS stealing the Friends theme and putting it on Good Morning America.
Turns out when CBS made Nadia from Romania with Love, hosted by Flip Wilson, they were actually using their own intellectual property.
That's a relief. I'm sure Flip Wilson wouldn't want to piss anyone off. And that concludes Nadia's theme, entry 823.PS5707, certificate number 25729 in the Omnibus, a show which is now entirely going to be about syrupy 1970s pop. We're going to do every Bread record. We're going to live listen to every Bread record in order. Going to have some Anne Murray, I already mentioned. It's going to be great. Futurelings, we were products of our time, not just in the AM radio department, also in social media. So you could always find us at Omnibus Project on the social media platforms of your choice. I was at Ken Jennings. John is at John Roderick. You could email us at theomnibusproject at gmail.com. But if you already emailed us mid-show to tell us we got the Young and the Restless networks wrong,
stop.
You should delete. unsend send one of those revoked follow-up emails.
Is that a thing?
I have somebody who does that. Like if they want to unsend something because they got a fact wrong, they will send a
revoked,
rescinded or whatever. And I don't think you can do that.
I accidentally sent a email to someone who was on the original email, and I was sending it to somebody else, but I didn't want to
about them.
Well, no, it wasn't that, but it definitely was one I didn't. And I wrote them and said, "Hey, delete that without reading it, please. It's not relevant and you don't want to read it. So leave it." And they wrote back and were like, "I deleted it. Thanks for telling me."
Wow, you're like a cult leader.
Yeah, so I don't know, but who knows if they did.
If you ever text me saying delete anything in my inbox, I will do it.
Ken, delete it.
Delete something from 3 years ago, not sent by me.
Delete all the mail that you've gotten from CBS.
Gmail now has a thing where if you send your email, it'll say sent and then be like, "Or did you mean to?"
Oh, really?
And I think all they do is they just hold off for 5 seconds.
Oh.
And give you a chance to be like, "No, wait." And I honestly think 3 or 4 times I've been like, "Wait, I wanted to, you know, I realized what I did wrong," and I actually yank it back right as it's leaving.
It's like the 5 second delay on Saturday Night Live.
Exactly. You're
like, "Oh, I wanted to add more swears to that."
Except now it's for adding swears. You could send us physical items at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. We just got a note from, Ren, who just did the Santiago de Compostela.
Oh, congratulations.
Pilgrimage, 500 miles, and listen to the show.
Yeah, he walked 500 miles.
I don't know
if he's going to walk 500 more.
Well, probably if he wants to get back to the airport. It may be a she. Isn't Ren usually? It's W-R-E-N.
Like, oh yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. To have misgendered
not
you,
like
Ren.
And well, we don't know.
Right.
We don't know. We won't speculate. What a great idea. Is that really a spiritual pilgrimage if you're listening to a podcast the whole time? I was slightly disappointed John only mentioned his walk across Europe 6 times.
Zing. You know what? Up yours, Ren. That's what I say about that.
We also got a note from a friend in Dothan, Alabama, the peanut capital of the world, who sends us kind of this vintage postcard from nearby Enterprise, Alabama.
Enterprise, Alabama. What is the Enterprise in Alabama?
Cotton, because the only thing I know about it is the boll weevil statue there.
Oh, sure.
In proud appreciation of the boll weevil. That's what the facts about the 50 states book I had as a kid had for there. Celeste manages the Martin drugstore
in Enterprise, Alabama.
I guess it recently moved from Enterprise to Dothan. Are we going to get zing?
Dothan?
Because it's not Dothan. How do you say the Alabama city?
Is it spelled Dothan or
no,
is it
Dothan?
Oh, Dothan. It is. But they probably say something else, don't they?
I don't know. The dictionary says Dothan.
Dothan.
Let's see.
Did you just say that with a fake Southern accent?
Dothan?
Dothan. Come on down to Dothan. Meet some friends, man.
She has a story about a couple from Germany who stopped in her drugstore to ask where to go for dinner. Mm-hmm. Luckily, it was the opening weekend of the National Peanut Festival, held every November since 1938, except for World War II and COVID.
That's not German?
Washington Carver was the first speaker.
The National Peanut Festival should be in Georgia, I would think.
Except for, I don't know, except for, oh, no, 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 wait. They like the boll, oh, here it is. They love the boll weevil there because the Enterprise in Alabama is not cotton. The boll weevil forced them to diversify and become a peanut center.
Oh.
So the Enterprise of Enterprise is peanut farming.
I get it.
I still think that's kind of a weird thing to thank the boll weevil for killing all the cotton.
Thank you, boll weevil.
It's like, I'm so glad we got penicillin out of World War I. Thank you, Kaiser.
Seems like thank you, boll weevil, is a President of the USA song.
Here's an exact quote from Celeste. I said, if you want Americana, you've got good timing, and sent them to the National Peanut Festival.
Hot diggity.
Thank you for letting us know. We also got Christmas presents.
Oh.
They're wrapped.
Oh.
And I don't know who from.
They look like books.
They do look like books.
Are they heavy like a book?
Would you like to open yours?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
The heaviest one of all says Mindy on it. I don't know why.
Oh.
They're now sending gifts to my family. That's lovely.
Yes.
I'm going to read the note here.
How to get a home divorce.
Dawn with a W. Something for my airplane rides.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a copy of Mad Libs.
See, hey, there you go.
I got Seattle-themed Mad Libs.
You love them.
And also a book of poetry called Other People's Comfort Keeps Me Up at Night, which is a pretty good name for a poetry collection. The poems have titles like On Children, How I Hate Them and Want to Corrupt Them. That's good.
Dawn writes an ampersand, which is kind of unusual to use ampersands in written correspondence these days. I tried to do it for a while.
I draw a mean ampersand.
But her ampersand looked to me at first like the numeral 8. And I thought she wrote, John, wishing you 8 years a Merry Christmas. And then I realized she actually said, wishing you and yours a Merry Christmas.
That does make sense. It's not like Hanukkah. There's not 8 crazy years every Christmas.
And here is what we got here at the bunker. The Star Wars Life Day Cookbook.
You got to celebrate Life Day with all the Wookiees and B. Arthur and possibly Alan Arkin? That's not right.
My daughter is going to be so thrilled. Although, are these all fake? No.
You're going to be making all those recipes.
The Kabatha crisps, the Kjalstad fizz.
But they're all going to be made with Earth ingredients, like the stuff you can buy at Star Wars Galaxy's Edge.
Yeah, let's see. Some of these instructions are actually in Elvish.
Sorry, Art Carney, not... Although Alan Arkin would have been funny. I knew it was a Mike Nichols leading man.
Art Carney. Oh, I miss him.
Yeah, in a galaxy far away, you got to have Art Carney and Jefferson Starship. What could be more Star Wars-y than that? I can't believe they haven't shown up in Book of Boba Fett yet.
Jefferson Starship?
Yeah. They could be Jefferson Star Destroyer.
Yeah, there you go.
See? And I didn't finish the thing, did I? There's also a Patreon that you could support. Would it kill you? Patreon.com/omnibusproject. You've been listening to us talk about the Carpenters for free for an hour.
Yeah.
I feel like you could throw us a few coins. Right? Right?
Right.
Least you can do.
Believe it. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.